welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. A little stressy today because we're redoing the kitchen and the bathroom, and we had a guy who was going to come in and do it, and then we decided to go with a different guy, and by the time we found the different guy and gotten his dates, the apartment we had lined up to stay in while we were away, the short-term rental, had collapsed, and so now we've got to find another place to live by March the 8th. And to compound things, for the first week, my wife is going to be away. She's going to be in San Francisco at the Game Developers Conference, so I'm going to have a week with the baby in an apartment that isn't ours, while supervising the guys who are redoing our kitchen. So it's all come to a head this morning. I've been calling short-term rental people. If you know of someone who wants to rent a place from March 8th to the 26th in or around Old Street Station in London, well, I guess not in Old Street Station in London. I don't think we want to live there. But around Old Street Station in London, has to be there, has to be walking distance to both the flat and to the baby's daycare. Do let me know. That's kind of a long shot, I admit. tomorrow night, Tuesday, I'm going to be at Ignite here in London. It's part of National Global Ignite Week, giving a short talk, 15, 20 minutes. It's a free event, 7 o'clock. I think I'm first. Hope to see you there. Almost done with Shannon's Law. That's the short story set in the Borderlands universe that I've been working on for a while. Should be done soon. And I've gotten some more information about my tour for the Win, my next young adult novel. It goes from May the 11th to 27th. And will hit, I'm not sure in what order, the following cities, tentatively anyway. Chicago, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Austin, and New York City, which will be completely awesome because I love all of those cities. So, that's the news that's fit to print. Now, let's read a little more of Clockwork Fagin. Sorry if me cracking my knuckles just grossed you out. Here's a little of Clockwork Fagin, written for Kelly Link and Gavin Grant's young adult steampunk anthology. And so we went, week on week, with small but impressive updates to our clockwork man, hands that could grasp and smoke a pipe, a clever mechanism that let him throw back his head and laugh, fingers that could drum on the table beside him, eyes that could follow you around a room, and eyelids that could blink, albeit slowly. But Monty had much bigger plans. "I want to bring in another 56 bits," he said, gesturing at the computing panel and grinder's parlor, a paltry 8-bit works. That meant that there were 8 switches with 8 matching levers, connected to 8 brass rods that ran down to the public computing works that ran beneath the streets of muddy York. Grinder had used his 8-bits to keep St. Aggie's books, both the set he showed to the sisters and the one where he kept track of what he was trousering for himself. And he'd let one lucky child work the great, stiff return arm that sent the instructions set on the switches back to the Hall of Computing for queuing and processing on the great frames that had cost me my good right arm. An instant later, the processed answer would be returned to the levers above the switches, and to whatever interpretive mechanism you had yoked up to them. Grinder used a telegraph machine that printed the answers upon a long, thin sheet of paper. 56 bits! I boggled at Monty. A 64-bit rig wasn't unheard of if you were a mighty shipping concern or an insurer. But in a private home, well, the racket of the switches would shake the foundations. Remember, dear reader, that each additional bit doubled the calculating facility of the home panel. Monty was proposing to increase St. Aggie's computational capacity by a factor of more than a quadrillion-fold. Well, we computer men are accustomed to dealing in these rarefied numbers, but they may boggle you. Have no fear, a quadrillion is a number of such surpassing monstrosity that you must have the knack of figuring even to approach it properly. Monty, I gasped, are you planning to open a firm of accountants at St. Aggie's? He laid a finger alongside of his nose. Not at all, my old darling. I have a thought that perhaps we could build a tiny figuring engine into our grinder's chest cavity, one that would take programs punched off of a sufficiently powerful computing frame, and that these might enable him to walk about on his own, as natural as you please, and even carry on conversations as though he were a living man. Such a creation would afford us even more freedom and security, as you must be able to see. But it will cost the bloody world, I said. Oh, I didn't think we'd pay for it, he said. Once again, he laid his finger alongside his nose. And that is how I came to find myself down our local sewer, in the dead of night, a 17-year-old brassjacker, bossing a gang of 8 kids with 10 arms, 7 noses, 9 hands, and 11 legs between them, working furiously and racing the dawn to fit thousands of precision brass pushrods with lightly balanced joints from the local multifarious amalgamation and amplification switch house to St. Aggie's utility cellar. It didn't work, of course. Not that night. But at least we didn't break anything and alert the Upper Canadian Computing Authority to our mischief. 3 nights later, after much fine-tuning, oiling, and desperate prayer, the panel at St. Aggie's boasted 64 shining brass bits, the very height of modernity and engineering. Monty and the children all stood before the panel, which had been burnished to a mirror shine by No-Nose Timmy, who'd done finishing work before a careless master had stumbled over him, pushing him face first into a spinning grinding wheel. In the gaslight, we appeared to be staring at a group of mighty heroes, and when Monty turned to regard us, he had bright tears in his eyes. "Sisters and brothers, we have done ourselves proud. A new day has dawned for St. Aggie's and for our lives. Thank you. You have done me proud." We shared out the last of Grinder's brandy, a thimbleful each, even for the smallest kiddies, and drank a toast to the brave and clever children of St. Aggie's, and to Montreal Monty, our savior and the founder of our feast. Let me tell you some about life at St. Aggie's in that golden age. Whereas before we'd rise at 7 a.m. for a mean breakfast prepared by unfavored children whom Grinder punished by putting them into the kitchen at 4:30 to prepare the meal, followed by a brief sermon roared out by Grinder, now we rose at a very civilized 10 a.m. to eat a leisurely breakfast over the daily papers that Grinder had subscribed to. The breakfasts, all the meals and chores, were done on a rotating basis, with exemptions for children whose infirmity made performing some tasks harder than others. Though all worked, even the blind children sorted weevils and stones from the rice and beans by touch. Whereas Grinder had sent us out to beg every day, excepting Sundays, debasing ourselves and putting our injuries on display for the purposes of sympathy, now we were free to laze around the house all day, or work at our own fancies, painting or reading or just playing like the cherished children of rich families who didn't need to send their young ones to the city to work for the family fortune. But most of us quickly bored of the life of Riley, and for us, there was plenty to do. The clockwork Grinder was always a distraction, especially after Monty started work on the mechanism that would accept punch tape instructions from the computing panel. When we weren't working on Grinder, there was other work. We former apprentices went back to our old masters, men and women who were guilty but glad enough to see us in the main, and told them that the skilled children of St. Aggie's were looking for piecework as part of our rehabilitation, at a competitive price. It was hardly a lie, either. As broken tools and mechanisms came in for mending, the boys and girls taught one another their crafts and trade, and it wasn't long before a steady flow of cash came into St. Aggie's, paying for better food, better clothes, and, soon enough, the very best artificial arms, legs, hands, and feet, the best glass eyes, the best wigs. When Gertie Shinepate was fitted for her first wig and saw herself in the great looking glass in Grinder's study, she burst into tears and hugged all and sundry, and thereafter St. Aggie's bought her 3 more wigs to wear as the mood struck her. She took to styling these wigs with combs and scissors, and before long, she was cutting hair for all of us at St. Aggie's. We never looked so good. That gilded time from the end of my boyhood is like a sweet dream to me now. A sweet, lost dream. No invention works right the first time around. The inventor's tales you read in the science penny dreadfuls, where some engineer discovers a new principle, puts it into practice, shouts Eureka, and sets up his own foundry? They're rubbish. Real invention is a process of repeated crushing failure that leads, very rarely, to a success. If you want to succeed faster, there's nothing for it but to fail faster and better. The first time Monty rolled a paper tape into a cartridge and inserted it into Grinder, we all held our breaths while he fished around in the arse of Grinder's trousers for the toggle that released the tension on the mainspring we wound through a keyhole in his hip. He stepped back as the soft whining of the mechanism emanated from Grinder's body, and then Grinder began, very slowly, to pace the room's length, taking 3 long, if jerky, steps, turning about and taking 3 steps back. Then Grinder lifted a hand as if in greeting, and his mouth stretched into a rictus that might have passed for a grin, and then, very carefully, Grinder punched himself in the face so hard that his head came free from his neck and rolled across the floor with a meaty sound. It took our resident taxidermists a full 2 days to repair the damage, and his body went into a horrible paroxysm like the St. Vitus dance until it, too, fell to the floor. This was on Monday, and by Wednesday we had Grinder back on his feet with his head reattached. Again, Monty depressed the toggle, and this time Grinder made a horrendous clanking sound and pitched forward. And so it went, day after day, each tiny improvement accompanied by abject failure, and each Sunday we struggled to put the pieces together so that Grinder could pay his respect to the sisters. Until the day that the sisters brought round a new child to join our happy clan, and it all began to unravel. We had been lucky in that Monty's arrival at St. Aggie's coincided with a reformers movement that swept Upper Canada, a movement whose figurehead, the Princess Lucy, met with every magistrate, councilman, alderman, and beadle in the colony, the sleeves of her dress pinned up to the stumps of her shoulders, sternly discussing the plight of the children who worked in the information foundries across the colonies. It didn't do no good in the long run, of course, but for the short term, word got round that the authorities would come down very hard on any master whose apprentice lost a piece of himself in the data mills. So it was some months before St. Aggie's had any new meat arrive upon its doorstep. The new meat in question was a weepy boy of about 11, the same age I'd been when I arrived, and he was shy his left leg all the way up to the hip. He had a cruel steel leg in its place, strapped up with a rough, badly cured cradle that must have hurt like hellfire. He also had a splintery crutch that he used to get around with, the sort of thing that the Sisters of St. Aggie's bought in huge lots from unscrupulous tradesmen who cared nothing for the people who'd come to use them. His name was William Sanssouci, a Métis boy who'd come from the wild woods of Lower Canada seeking work in Muddy York, who'd found instead an implacable machine that had torn off his leg and devoured it without a second's remorse. He spoke English with a thick French accent and slipped into joual when he was overcome with sorrow. Two sisters brought him to the door on a Friday afternoon. We knew they were coming. They'd sent round a messenger boy with a printed telegram telling Grinder to make room for one more. Monty wanted to turn his clockwork Grinder loose to walk to the door and greet them, but we all told him he'd be mad to try it. There was so much that could go wrong, and if the sisters worked out what had happened, we could finish up dangling from nooses at the King Street jail. Monty relented resentfully, and instead we seated Grinder in his overstuffed chair, with Monty tucked away behind it, ready to converse with the sisters. I hid with him, ready to send Grinder to his feet and to extend his cold, leathery, artificial hand to the boy when the sisters turned him over. And it went smoothly. That day, when the sisters had gone and their car had built up its head of steam and chuffed and clanked away, we emerged from our hiding place. Monty broke into slangy, rapid French, gesticulating and hopping from foot to peg leg and back again, and William's eyes grew as big as saucers as Monty explained the lay of the land to him. The clang when he thumped Grinder in his cast-iron chest made William leap back, and he hobbled toward the door. "Wait, wait," Monty called, switching to English. "Wait, will you, you idiot? This is the best day of your life, young William, but for us, you might have entered a life of miserable bondage. Instead, you will enjoy all the fruits of liberty, rewarding work and comradeship. We take care of our own here at St. Aggie's. You'll have top grub, a posh leg, and a beautiful crutch that's as smooth as a baby's arse and soft as a lady's bosom. You'll have the freedom to come and go as you please, and you'll have a warm bed to sleep in every night, and best of all, you'll have us, your family here at St. Aggie's. We take care of our own, we do." The boy looked at us, tears streaming down his face. He made me remember what it had been like my first day at St. Aggie's, the cold fear coiled round your guts like a rope caught in a reciprocating gear. At St. Aggie's we put on brave faces, never cried where no one could see us, but seeing him weep made me remember all the times I'd cried. Cried for my lost family who'd sold me into indenture, cried for my mangled body, my ruined life. But living without Grinder's constant terrorizing must have softened my heart. Suddenly, it was all I could do to stop myself from giving the poor little mite a one-armed hug. I didn't hug him, but Monty did, stumping over to him, and the two of them bawled like babbies. Their peg legs knocked together as they embraced like drunken sailors, and seeming to cry out every tear we'd any of us ever held in. Before long, we were all crying with them, fat tears streaming down our faces, the sound like something out of the pit. When the sobs had stopped, William looked at us, wiped his nose, and said, "Thank you. I think I am home." All right, then. I'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike, US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, This song is copyrighted in the U.S. under seal of copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time, self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.